Lord Chris Patten, as the government's coordinator of the papal visit to the UK, how do you first of all explain what most people are describing as really quite an unexpected success?
Well, I'm not sure they should have regarded it as unexpected. I think pretty well every visit His Holiness has made has been preceded by rather sceptical commentary on how it's going to go, and then it's proved to be very successful. I was in the United States when he went there, and the visit was a huge triumph. I think the reasons for the success were principally threefold. First of all, His Holiness himself. I mean, a lot of the commentary has rather slid past the point that this was a hugely tiring, demanding program, which he managed with great elan, in a language with which, it's no criticism, he's not comfortable. And to have done it all as wonderfully well as he did is a great tribute to him personally. Secondly, it was in a sense a stick in the eye for metropolitan cynicism. What made the trip a success from the very beginning was the turnout of the crowds, Catholic and non-Catholic alike, who wanted to wish him well. And for some of us, the most wonderful sight was not just the social mix of worshippers at the masses and the vigil, but the young kids. I mean, very normal teenagers with funny T-shirts and banners and enjoying themselves. The organizers of the event in Hyde Park had expected it to be like the normal proms in the park, a sort of concert, a classical concert, you know, and rather staid and middle class. They were amazed when it turned into something like a pop concert. But even so, at moments, there was complete silence during the vigil. So that was one of the reasons for the success. Thirdly, I think not just the messenger and the people to whom the message was delivered, but the message itself, thoughtful, quite challenging, but I can't remember a recent visit by any world figure which has left behind so much debate about really serious issues. So I think from our point of view, as the Prime Minister made clear when Pope Benedict was leaving Birmingham, I think it was a huge success.
As you say, it was indeed an action-packed 4 days, a very intense programme. What perhaps were your personal highlights?
I most enjoyed the Friday and Saturday morning. First of all, the speech in Westminster Hall, which is a building which is iconic, really, in British history. The building where Thomas More, said to be the patron saint of politicians, because he's a man of conscience. Unfortunately, none of politicians perhaps are. But an iconic building in British history. And the Pope made this very, very interesting speech about the relationship between faith and reason and the rule of law in a moderate, tolerant society. Then we went across the road, as it were, for the great ecumenical service in Westminster Abbey. And I will never forget, I'm married to a member of the Church of England, and for her it was, and for both of us, it was a moment of great joy when the Archbishop of Canterbury and the Pope entered that wonderful medieval building to the sound of the Church's one foundation. It was Church of England liturgy at its finest. And then the following morning we had that wonderful Mass in Westminster Cathedral with a great piece of music to open it by James Macmillan, the Scottish composer, Tuas Petrus, which took the roof off the cathedral. So there were a lot of very good moments as well, but those for me were the highlights.
As you said, the Pope left behind some quite challenging questions, didn't he? If you had to suggest perhaps what might be the longer term impact of the visit, what would you like to see coming out of it?
I'd like to see members of faith groups, first of all, recognizing the wisdom of what the chief rabbi said. One of the characteristics of the visit was the very fine speeches which it elicited from others, and in particular, the chief rabbi and the Archbishop of Canterbury made some extraordinarily good speeches. And the chief rabbi noted that one of the things that put people off faith was the difficulty that faith groups had had over the years in working together and not fighting one another. It was put much more elegantly than that. So I think first of all, faith groups, I hope, will recognise what they have in common, and we're really talking principally about, not entirely, but principally about groups which have their paternity in Abraham. Secondly, I hope that it will make people who belong to faith groups more self-confident about saying so, and I hope we'll end some of the, you know, these things may be exaggerated sometime, but these sort of ridiculous ways in which alleged political correctness has led to the siege of people who belong to faith groups. You know, that ridiculous and rather awful business a few years ago when an employee of British Airways was stopped from wearing a crucifix. I also hope that it will encourage secularists to be serious rather than abusive. It was for me rather a disappointment to see people who are serious, or said to be serious, professors and lawyers getting involved in the most abusive commentary. I mean, not many of them, but a few, about the Catholic Church and about religion in general. And I hope that they will recognise that there's actually a serious debate to be had, that the Pope and the Catholic Church want to get in a serious debate, not a debate in which the Catholic Church says it wants to run everything, but a debate in which people who do belong to faith groups say, look, you know, we have a contribution to make to creating ethical foundations for politics and policymaking. So I hope those things will result from the visit.
So really raising the tone, perhaps, of the debate between faith and reason. It's an optimistic a hope.
Yes, it is a bit optimistic, because we are said to live in a world of 24-hour news cycles, of sound bites. Well, we shouldn't allow that to crimp and confine intelligent discussion and debate. One of my favourite remarks by a politician was Adlai Stevenson's observation that the average man and woman is a great deal better than the average. And it's nice to hear people like the Archbishop of Canterbury and His Holiness and the Chief Rabbi acting on that. I wish a few more politicians would.
What about reactions from within the Catholic community there in Britain? Certainly the Pope was appealing for a much more vibrant debate between faith and reason, and it seemed that people in Britain were listening to what he had to say. Do you think the other way round is also true? Do you think, in a sense, the Pope was able to hear the very distinctive voice of the Catholic Church in Britain today?
I very much hope so. I hope that he will have been as impressed as I was by the sign of the vitality of the Catholic Church, and a point I made earlier, its enormous range. You look at those queues of people going up for communion, every age, every social class, every colour, every race, an extraordinary social mix, and a great deal of joy about the way people were celebrating their religion. Joy even in the soggiest circumstances before the Mass in Birmingham. And being reminded on that occasion of one of the greatest of England's Catholics. It started so magnificently in Edinburgh and that great park in Glasgow with the cheering crowds and the yellow and white flags alongside the blue and white crosses of St. Andrew. It started wonderfully well there, and I hope that from that moment on, His Holiness and his colleagues from the Vatican will have been impressed by what they saw of the vitality of English and Scottish Catholicism.
There are those within the Catholic Church in Britain who are very keen to engage in this debate, and yet somehow, perhaps women particularly, feel that their voices aren't heard here in the Vatican.
Yes, indeed. I mean, I want to avoid turning myself into a commentator on the precise state of the Catholic Church. There are people who feel very passionately about issues like gender, the role of women in the church, a church which wouldn't exist had it not been for the way women behaved on Good Friday and when all the men ran away. There are people who are very worried about attitudes to gays in the church. I mean, I've always assumed myself that there are a lot of devout gays in the Catholic Church and that God must love them particularly strongly because of the extent of discrimination that they've felt over the years, not least in the past from parts of the Catholic Church itself. So all those issues, of course, get discussed, and I hope are discussed in a way which doesn't open divisions within the church itself and in a way which doesn't ever take away from our fundamental agreement about the most important aspect of our religion being the resurrection.
Finally, you're here in Rome for this Congress discussing the future of European society, of course, one of the Pope's deepest concerns. What else do you think the churches can do to become more effective players on the European stage?
It's interesting that if you look back to the foundations of the European Union, and it's perhaps something that made people in my own country a bit suspicious of it in the past, many of the founding fathers were very strong intellectual Catholics, and a lot of the foundations of the European Union you can trace to Catholic social teaching over the last 100 or so years, concepts like subsidiarity. So I think that religion, Catholicism, has played a large part in the way that the European Union has been created. I don't mean by that we should assign the common agricultural policy to the catechism, but I do think that religion has played an important part. And I hope it will play an important part in the next few years in ensuring that the European Union isn't inward-looking, continues to be extrovert, and continues to offer a model of living which combines prosperity with social solidarity and political stability. Those are all, I would have hoped, the aims and objectives. We face huge challenges in Europe, not least because we have a falling share of the world's population, a stuttering underlying rate of growth, and may well find ourselves over the next few years, as a result of those things, with a falling share of world trade and world output as well, and therefore not perhaps as well placed to offer lessons and advice to the rest of the world. So there's plenty for us to do, but I think also plenty of inspiration to take from Catholic philosophers and the Catholic tradition.
Thank you very much indeed.